Thank you. A big round of applause. Thanks so much for coming out today, comrades. So this talk is entitled Torture, Rendition and Massacre, the War on Terror 20 plus years ago. So I'm going to cover how it began, the interventions into Afghanistan and Iraq, its domestic implications in Australia, and then I'm just going to touch on some of the debates on the left that were occurring throughout the period. But first, for those who were not politically conscious or perhaps not even born at the time, what was happening 24 years ago? So as always, our starting point is understanding capitalism and imperialism. Capitalism produces imperialism, competition between major powers and their corporations for control over world markets. And this dynamic creates a hierarchy of states with powerful nations at the top, sub-imperial nations and powers beneath, and oppressed nations at the bottom. However, no hierarchy is permanent. And Trotsky's concept of uneven and combined development illustrates how capitalism's inability and instability through economic booms and busts, corporate competition, and resistance from the oppressed constantly reshapes global power structures, resulting in successive orders dominated by different powers. So, after the Soviet Union's collapse in 1991, the United States ushered in a unipolar order of neoliberal globalization with unmatched influence and little geopolitical rivalry. Through military intervention and economic influence, the US sought to create a rules-based order to support the global expansion of capitalism under its hegemony, particularly focusing on strategic regions like the Middle East, essential for global oil markets and trade. Despite the appearance of, at the time, an unchallenged unipolar world, US policymakers, especially neoconservatives, felt an unease over rising powers like the EU and China. In response, they established the Project for a New American Century, or PNAC, in 1997, advocating for an interventionist foreign policy to secure US dominance through increased military power and alliances with democratic nations, while challenging regimes opposing US interests. PNAC's 1997 policy document emphasized that maintaining military strength was essential for securing American peace, and warned that failing to do so could jeopardize US interests globally. This vision significantly influenced the Bush administration's foreign policy, with key PNAC members like Cheney and Rumsfeld holding high-ranking positions. But what was their plan specifically? To achieve this, Project for a New American Century called for significant increases in defence spending alongside efforts to spread political and economic freedom abroad. Their statement encouraged strengthening alliances with democratic nations and actively challenging regimes that opposed American values and interests. Of the 25 people who signed PNAC's founding statement, 10 went on to hold high-ranking positions within the Bush administration, including Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz. So this image that you can see up here, you won't be able to read. You might be able to see some of the names there. So in 1998, the organization sent a letter to President Bill Clinton, advocating for the removal of the then president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, from power. They argued that Hussein's regime posed a threat to both American interest and regional stability. And this letter demonstrates that there was a pre-existing plan that had the backing of powerful players and was openly courting the ruling class. So this was dated back in 1998, so remember that date. So we know that the neocons already had a strategy, a plan in their back pocket, which was gaining support, influence, and traction within the US ruling class, particularly now that the Republicans were holding office. What they were lacking was a trigger to activate it and a justification to ensure its implementation and acceptance with the broader public. So the September 11 attacks in 2001 became that catalyst for a sweeping and aggressive shift in US foreign policy. On that Tuesday morning, 19 terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners scheduled to travel from the East Coast to California. The first two teams of hijackers crashed the first two planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, while the remaining hijackers aimed the next two flights towards targets in or near Washington, D.C., in attack on the nation's capital, the actual belly of the beast. The third team succeeded in striking the Pentagon, the headquarters of the US Department of Defense in Arlington County, Virginia, while the fourth plane crashed in rural Pennsylvania during a passenger revolt. It was thought that the intended target was either the United States Capitol building or the White House itself. Alerted to previous attacks, the passengers, in an incredible act of bravery, revolted against the hijackers, who then crashed the aircraft into Stony Creek Township Field in Pennsylvania. And I just can't overemphasize that this attack sent absolute shockwaves around the globe and has since become an absolute key defining moment in world history. The aircraft hijackers were 19 men affiliated with jihadist organization Al-Qaeda. They hailed from four countries. 15 of them were citizens of Saudi Arabia, two were from the United Arab Emirates, and one was from Egypt, one from Lebanon also. None were from Afghanistan or Iraq. While the tragedy of nearly 3,000 people who were killed on US soil on that day generated worldwide shock and sympathy, the US government quickly transformed this horrifying moment into a justification for what would become decades of violent interventions across the Middle East. The then National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, literally instructed her senior national security staff to, quote unquote, to think about how do you capitalize on these opportunities, drawing a comparison to the period between 1945 and 1947 at the start of the Cold War. So, yeah, the death of 3,000 American citizens was literally seen as an opportunity. So, the corporate media played a really key role in shaping public perception on the War on Terror, as it was to become known, as a necessary campaign for freedom, justice, and security. In the immediate days, weeks, and months after September 11, the war drums began beating, and we can still hear them today. Framed as a humanitarian intervention, it was sold as a just cause to dismantle terrorist networks and protect civilians. This narrative, supported by mainstream media outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post, masked broader strategic goals, gaining public and international support, a compliant press that absolutely amplified the administration's spin. So, what was Australia's involvement? Australia enthusiastically supported the invasion of Iraq and then later Iraq, aligning itself with American imperialist interests. But rather than being a reluctant partner, weak or lackey or a lapdog, as some in the anti-war movement at the time believed, John Howard and the Australian government saw that a strengthened alliance with US would further its own imperialist interest in the Asia-Pacific region. We see this commitment to the US alliance today around what's happening currently with Palestine and the commitment to the war there. So that's still an ongoing feature of Australian capitalism. But at the time, the Australian government not only sort of gave diplomatic support, but provided troops, shared military intelligence, and offered logistical support as well. On October 7, 2001, the US and Britain launched airstrikes on Afghanistan, initiating Operation Enduring Freedom as the first formal military invasion on the War on Terror. While aimed at targeting Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, who were ruling Afghanistan at the time, and Al-Qaeda, who sought refuge under the wing of the Taliban, it also signalled the US's intent to assert control in the oil-rich Middle East, a region of critical geopolitical value. The campaign continued under NATO support, with allies such as Australia, Canada, France joining, with many more following suit. So I'm not sure whether people are familiar with the Taliban, but they were a group that emerged and in around 1996, they seized Kabul. They instituted a really severe interpretation of Islamic law that, for example, forbade female education and prescribed the severing of hands or even execution as punishment for petty crimes. And that same year, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden was welcomed to Afghanistan, having been expelled from Sudan, and established his organization's headquarters there. With Al-Qaeda's help, the Taliban won control over 90% of Afghan territory by the summer of 2001. So these were not people that were supportable in any sense of the word. They were horrific. So just quickly on the strategic importance of this area of the world. So control of this region meant not just access to oil and gas, but also control of the Suez Canal, a crucial artery for international trade that links Europe and Asia. The Suez Canal handles about 12% of global trade and is accessed by vessels travelling from Asia via the 30-kilometre wide Bab el-Mandeb Strait. About half of freight shipped through the canal is made up of containerized goods, which is estimated to be over $1 trillion US dollars worth of goods per year. So this route also provides a vital passage for shipments of oil from the Persian Gulf to Europe and North America. So it's incredibly important for a whole range of reasons, not only to have control over it, but to make sure that others, other imperialists don't have it as well. So recent developments have underscored the continuing significance of this trade route. For example, in light of recent events where we've seen the Houthi rebels attacking vessels in the Red Sea. So the costs associated with redirecting the ships around that canal were estimated that were up to $1 million in extra fuel for each round trip between Asia and Europe. Okay, so what was the human cost? Operation Enduring Freedom officially continued for 13 years. Under this umbrella, the US undertook covert counter-terrorism operations in the Philippines, Horn of Africa, the Caribbean, Central America, and Kyrgyzstan. Although the West has not consistently tracked civilian casualties, estimates suggest that up to 4.5 million people died as a result of the war on terror. The scale of civilian suffering was immense and is still being felt today across the region. The impact it has had on countless lives cannot be understated. This is literally what barbarism looks like. So, how did they justify this? They used a number of different ways. So, the United States and its allies framed their invasion of Afghanistan as a mission to liberate Afghan women, using this narrative as a moral justification for war. High-profile figures, including Cherie Blair and Laura Bush, partners of the President and Prime Minister of England at the time, promoted this idea with support from Western feminists, lending credibility to the claim that intervention would secure Afghan women's rights. This narrative was reinforced by reports from the US State Department, such as the Taliban War Against Women, and was embraced by prominent Western feminists, some of whom were literally invited to the State Department when the invasion was announced. Shame. Shamefully, many Western liberals and some on the left fell into line, openly supporting or giving credence to the intervention on a spurious basis of encouraging secular democracy or opposition to the Taliban's treatment of women, which obviously was horrendous. While dissenting voices on the left who protested the war were sidelined, labelled as mistaken or simply naive. However, more than two decades later, those dissenting voices, people here will have been included in that as well too, who were around at the time, those dissenting voices have been vindicated with the promise of liberation proved absolutely hollow. Civilian casualties soared, and rather than achieving liberation, the intervention intensified violence and worsened conditions, leaving Afghan women and society to suffer under the unfulfilled promises of Western power. And far from bringing peace and stability, Western forces committed absolute atrocities against combatants and civilians. People might remember the 2020 Brereton report revealed systematic war crimes on the part of Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan, including the murder of 39 civilians and prisoners, the desecration of corpses, and the planting of evidence. So, If the justification for the invasion of Afghanistan had been tenuous, the case for war in Iraq had to be built on an absolute pack of lies. Framed by the US as a mission to counter a supposed existential threat from Saddam Hussein's alleged possession of weapons of mass destruction, or WMDs, and ties to Al-Qaeda. President George W. Bush claimed that Iraq was part of an axis of evil, positioning the war as part of a broader post 9/11 struggle against terrorism. In reality, the US had once actually considered Saddam Hussein as an ally, supporting his regime during the 1980s, including his brutal chemical attacks on the Kurds, which the US downplayed at the time. Only when Saddam challenged US interests by invading Kuwait in 1990 did he become considered a rogue state in Washington's views. Devastating sanctions imposed on Iraq after the Gulf War caused widespread suffering, with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright justifying the death of 1.5 million Iraqi children as, quote unquote, worth it. So, what was America trying to achieve? They wanted four things. Firstly, they wanted to keep Russia and China, the two growing powers, in check and frustrate their efforts into the region. Secondly, they wanted to maintain its prestige as the global superpower through a display of unrivaled military power. Third, they wanted to get rid of Hussein, who was an outspoken critic of America and was a blight on their image, and regime change hasn't been effective through sanctions. And fourthly, Iraq was seen as a stepping stone for further interventions and regime changes in the region, particularly Iran. So just to note, WMDs were never discovered. They never found any. Okay, so the US used multiple justifications to rationalise its interventions into the Middle East, claiming aims like spreading democracy, ensuring human rights, and liberating Afghan women, weapons of mass destruction, etc. But, you know, their key ideological plank to justify and maintain their invasions was Islamophobia, which the war on terror institutionalised and then globalised. So Orientalism was not a new thing and had been fostered by colonising forces across the region, particularly after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the carving up of the region by Sykes-Picot. But this took it to an absolutely new level. This campaign positioned Muslims broadly as security threats and led to widespread profiling, surveillance, and discrimination. Governments around the world carried out raids targeting Muslims, deporting people, arresting people, and classifying Muslim institutions and associations as potential terrorist organizations. And this went on for decades. So, just to start on some of the debates that were happening at the time on the left. Hard right Islamophobic attitudes were bolstered by influential figures in the new atheism movement. People such as Sam Harris began writing The End of Faith. You might know him from his meditation app. Immediately after the World Trade Center attacks, and that book became a bestseller. There followed the philosopher Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, and Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great. So Christopher Hitchens claims to have been a Trotskyist at one point of time. The new atheist portrays Islam as not just as a religion, but inherently incompatible with liberal values, which of course was what the US purported to be exporting as part of its aggressive wars, bourgeois values such as freedom, democracy, justice, and human rights. Were supposed to come sort of raining down from airstrikes above. Here we saw academia and the moderates walking hand in hand with the state, military, and government forces. So while seemingly less reactionary, the not all Muslims are bad logic works in insidiously racist ways. Rather than suggesting that war, imperialism, and structural class inequalities are the greatest enemy facing humankind, liberal Islamophobia agrees with the foundational premise of the conservatives: terrorism and religious, read Islamic, fanaticisms are the main problem in society. This logic then accepts that something has to be done about Muslims, especially young, radicalizing Muslims. And thus, the misdirection continues and Muslims continue to be targeted. Their culture, their schools, their religion, their social practices are all investigated in the search for the original sin of violent jihad. New atheists accepted the train of the debate set out by the conservatives. And one of the most telling debates at the time was around whether or not the constant surveillance, targeting, profiling, and repression of Muslims even constituted racism. Pedants like Dawkins and Harris maintained that Muslims do not constitute a race, so therefore racism is not an appropriate term to use in discussions of Islam and Western society, in some sort of bizarre gotcha moment. But of course, the term racism can and should be used to describe the oppression of Muslims in Western countries. These types of arguments that deny it at best provide a cover for bigotry and racism, at worst are simply an attempt to excuse the demonization of Muslims. So this focus on secularism and liberal values led to an increased scrutiny of Muslim communities under the guise of counter-terrorism, while obscuring the capitalist roots of conflict. So this kind of rhetoric was used to justify just the most appalling abuses of human rights outside the US. In Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, the US military and CIA tortured Iraqi prisoners. Thousands were rounded up in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and, without any trial, tortured in US rendition centres, then sent to Guantanamo Bay, where they were kept in degrading, soul-destroying conditions for years. Australia's complicity in these atrocities ensured that Islamophobia would remain an important aspect of government policies. Guantanamo Bay stands as one of the most infamous symbols of the US post 9/11 war on terror. Established by President George W. Bush in 2002, the detention facility has held at least 780 detainees from 48 countries. Of these, over 740 have been transferred elsewhere, 9 have died in custody, and only 16 have ever been charged with any offence. This was not a prison in the traditional sense, but a site for torture and indefinite detention, far from legal observation and oversight. Abu Zubaydah, a Palestinian detainee held at Guantanamo for over 2 decades, exemplifies the brutality and legal limbo enforced by this system. Zubaydah has never been charged with a crime, yet he endures what lawyers call the status of a forever prisoner. Held without any hope of release. Zubaydah's drawings, which you can see some of up here, depict the torture he suffered in CIA dark sites in Poland, Lithuania, and elsewhere, offering a really harrowing view into the human cost of these practices. Between 2002 and 2006, he was the first person to be subjected to methods designed to break prisoners physically and mentally, including being waterboarded 86 times, confinement in coffin-like boxes, you can see a picture of that he drew, sleep deprivation, beatings, and sexual humiliation. These accounts reveal not only the physical suffering inflicted upon detainees, but also the systematic degradation of their dignity. These methods had been cleared by senior US officials like Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and okayed by the Democrats, such as Nancy Pelosi. The US had initially justified Zubaydah's detention by claiming that he was a senior Al-Qaeda operative, only to later admit that he was not even a member of the group. As Zubaydah's lawyers remarked, everybody agrees they tortured the wrong guy. Yet the US proceeded with his torture to validate their brutal methods and justify future use of these techniques on countless others. Zubaydah is still there today. He's age 53. Okay, so moving on to what was the opposition at the time. So unlike the intervention into Afghanistan, the war in Iraq sparked mass protests. In early 2003, an unprecedented global anti-war movement emerged against the impending US-led invasion of Iraq. Millions of people across diverse backgrounds took to the streets, uniting under slogans like "No blood for oil," as they saw through the rhetoric of freedom and democracy and identified deeper motives for war, including control over oil and the US's desire to assert dominance. The opposition reached a historic scale, surpassing even that of the anti-Vietnam War protests, and included record-breaking rallies in cities like Sydney, where 500,000 people gathered. Despite this global outcry and the opposition of several key governments, the Bush administration continued to push forward, assembling a small coalition of the willing to launch an invasion. And it was really amazing. Over 3 million people marched in Rome, 1.5 million people did the same in Madrid, and it seemed at the time like the entire world was united in opposition. But within weeks, coalition forces took Baghdad and the US declared victory. So within the left, there were a number of debates. Many anti-war activists saw the invasion of Iraq, they saw it as a war primarily for oil. People like Dick Cheney, who was an ex-CEO of multinational oil company Halliburton, was simply in it for more barrels of oil. While oil was definitely a big factor in making Iraq and the region extremely important, it only really explained half of the story. Others focused on the role of the UN and the demand that they played more of a role. But the big one was, at the time, we've seen these big protests, but why hasn't it worked? We didn't stop the war. So revolutionaries argued at the time that it was not enough to oppose this particular war, though that was a good start for many progressives, but that it was also necessary to impose imperialism itself. This approach, rather than one that starts with process or involvement or otherwise of the United Nations, was crucial to developing a consistent opposition to war and to understanding its causes and how war can be ended for good. Despite their size, a few mass protests were never on their own going to stop an empire hell-bent on war to enforce its rule around the globe. Bush and his Western cronies were able to dismiss the global opposition to war and bomb and invade Iraq anyway. Nonetheless, the protests indicated the immense capacity of people to show international solidarity in spite of the considerable divide and rule efforts from all of our governments. The Iraq War became a symbol of the dangers of unchecked imperialism and the importance of a consistent, principled opposition to it. So, the War on Terror spilled over into draconian anti-terror laws directed against Muslim populations of Australia and other Western countries, and into opposition of the construction of mosques, of Muslim schools, bans on women wearing hijab, and a relentless barrage of anti-Muslim propaganda. Justifying these crimes against humanity required the creation of a hysterical climate of fear, a concerted effort. The stoking of Islamophobia and demonising and criminalising of Muslims have become the key means by which the US and its Western allies both excuse both imperialist interventions and a mass offensive against civil liberties. In the political environment after 9/11, John Howard, who was the Prime Minister at the time, enacted some of the most draconian national security laws in the Western world. A suite of anti-terror laws, including the Anti-Terrorism Act, undermined civil liberties here more than President George W. Bush's notorious Patriot Act did in the United States, granting greater powers for surveillance, warrantless searches and detention without charge. The Liberals, with Labor's backing, of course, pushed through draconian ASIO laws, giving the security forces virtually unlimited powers. ASIO was given the new ability to imprison people without charge and the removal of the right to silence. While initially intended to be used to target Muslims and people of Middle Eastern appearance, these laws and powers inevitably flowed on to be used against the left and militant unions. So, 2001 was a watershed in Australian politics. The year that the Liberal federal government, led by John Howard, enacted the Pacific solution of offshore imprisonment of refugees and asylum seekers. It thumbed its nose at the Aboriginal stolen generations. It joined the US-led war on terror and participated in the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, which became Australia's longest war. And then, of course, obviously, they joined in Iraq too. Howard should be remembered for the refugee families, many fleeing from the wars that Australia was partaking in, locked up in their thousands in remote prisons such as Woomera, Baxter and Port Hedland, and in the offshore gulags of Nauru and Christmas Island and Manus Island. His government plumbed new depths when it came to the brutal treatment of asylum seekers. But two incidences, incidents really marks John Howard as a man ahead of the curve for cruelty, the Tampa and the Children Overboard affairs. Well, at the time I'd been joining anti-war protests, it was these two incidents that radicalised me and turned me into an activist and then later a socialist. And that image up there is of the Tampa. In August 2001, a Norwegian freighter, the MV Tampa, rescued more than 400 refugees from a distressed fishing boat trying to reach Christmas Island in the Northern Indian Ocean. When the government's threats to prosecute the ship's captain failed to prevent it entering Australian waters, Howard sent the military to intercept the Tampa to prevent the refugees from exercising their right to seek safety. He sent the military to stop them. Australian soldiers boarded the ship and, after a standoff, forced refugees at gunpoint onto a Navy vessel that took them to a prison camp 7,000 kilometres away on the Pacific island of Nauru. Howard's government then rushed through legislation to retroactively make his actions legal. In a creative piece of legal manoeuvring and with Labor Party's support, John Howard changed the law to remove certain parts of Australian territory from the country's migration zone. This kind of legal magic became the norm under both Labor and Liberal governments, reaching its zenith when Labor Prime Minister Julia Gillard excised the entire Australian mainland from the migration zone in 2013. So, the day after Howard announced that a federal election was to be held, the Navy intercepted another fishing vessel, a boat known as the Civ 4, suspected illegal entry vessel 4, which was carrying more than 200 refugees to Christmas Island. In an act of political bastardry, government ministers falsely accused the rescued asylum seekers of blackmailing the government by threatening to drown their own children if they were not taken to Australia. Photos were released and splashed across the media, purporting to show that children had been thrown overboard. The reality was, of course, that the fishing vessel was in distress and sinking fast. The refugees had needed to be rescued. The Tampa affair and the Children Overboard lies fueled an election campaign infused with racism. Howard infamously declared during the campaign, "We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come." Islamophobia also played an important role in domestic politics. The demonisation of Muslims served as a weapon of mass distraction, displacing anger and concern over working class issues onto fear and hysteria about the so-called Muslim enemy within. Anti-Muslim demagogy had also served to shape a broader climate of hostility to migrants, refugees, and other non-Anglo sections of Australian society, a classic ruling class tactic of divide and rule. It led to the increase of military spending, the militarisation of police and Fortress Australia, which was then later to be exported as a model for Europe. The repressive laws were introduced to fight terrorists were then used as a model for attacks on unions or directly used against unions. For example, of the Australian Building and Construction Commission, the body established to persecute and prosecute construction workers, and the increasing tendency to remove the right to silence for trade unionists and activists. So this period was decisive in shifting Australian political culture to the right, the effects of which were to be felt for the next decade or two. The rise of Pauline Hanson, the race riots of Cronulla, the emergence of Reclaim Australia, the True Blue Crew, Antipodean Resistance, and the National Socialist Networks and other far-right groups all crawled their way out of the cesspit. While history has shown us that the US ultimately failed to fully realise its objectives and the unipolar order gradually faded, the resurgence of Russia, the rise of China as an economic powerhouse, and the failures of the US interventions all contributed to a new asymmetric multipolar world. and this marks the current phase of global power dynamics, a complex world order where US influence remains significant but is increasingly challenged by other powerful states. And of course, today, as we see, the Middle East remains a battleground with the ongoing genocide occurring in Palestine as the US seeks to regain its hegemony. And that's the end of my talk.